Hi, this is Mike Ferguson.
And this is Mike Morford, and we want to tell you about our true crime podcast, Criminology.
Launched in 2017, we've covered every kind of case you can imagine, from puzzling missing persons cases to mysterious murders.
Some of the cases we cover are the biggest in true crime history, or they're high-profile cases that are currently making headlines, while some of the cases are fascinating ones you likely haven't heard of.
We cover both solved and unsolved cases, and we have 300 episodes available to binge on right now, including full seasons on the Zodiac Killer, the Golden State Killer, and Ted Bundy.
You can listen to Criminology on your favorite player or app, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Hello, Amy, and hello, listeners. Today's case takes us to New Jersey Institute of Technology, or NJIT, in the city of Newark. Another case that's local to us. I know we've covered a lot of tri-state area stories this season, which I'm sure could be attributed to some location bias, but also because there are just a lot of universities in our area with really interesting cases that haven't gotten as much attention. So we hope that our listeners have enjoyed some of these more obscure cases. We've certainly learned a lot in researching them, and we hope that you learn a lot as well. If you liked a particular episode, we'd love to hear about it. Drop us a review with your favorite case, or leave us a post on our Facebook page and let us know which episode you think you learned the most about. And if there's a case that's local to you and you'd like for us to cover it, send us a message and let us know. We'd love to research it. Now on to our episode today. One of the reasons I picked this case, Amy, besides the fact that it was not heavily covered, is that it's an instance where the university did everything it could to prevent something terrible from happening, but it happened anyway. We talk a lot on this show about policies and places where schools did not do the best in looking out for the safety of their students. So I thought it would be good to highlight one where they did, and to point out the fact that even when we're doing everything we can do, tragedy can still occur. So let's get into it by learning a little about the university. The New Jersey Institute of Technology was founded by the Newark Board of Trade in 1885. Originally called the Newark Technical School, it was established as part of a 19th century legislative act to provide inner cities with schools of industrial education. Newark's technical school's first class had 88 evening students who met in an old rented mansion. But over the next year, the student population expanded very quickly, and the school board ran a capital campaign to begin building a designated campus, a proper campus. So by the 1920s, the co-ed industrial school, by the way, co-ed was very progressive for the time period, had added Greek life to their campus. We've discussed this before, but you were not in Greek life, correct?
For one semester.
Oh yeah, what happened?
Wasn't my thing.
Gotcha, okay.
I didn't like being told what to do.
Actually surprises me that I wound up staying in Greek life then. I too resented being told what to do. Now, I found it interesting that there were no dormitories or any on-campus housing options for students until 1979. That's a long time. Wow. So anyone in Greek life had to have chapter houses off-campus, and essentially all students were commuters. Another school expanded to university status and became the New Jersey Institute of Technology in the 1970s, which I'm sure you've heard of. Many Greek life chapter houses continue to remain off campus even after the creation of dormitories and the acquisition of new buildings. I think it was probably better for most of them to have their chapters off campus at that point. Mm-hmm. And it's not unusual. Many universities have off-campus Greek housing, but NJIT is located in the city of Newark, which has not always been described as the safest of places. The university has worked diligently since the 1980s to move Greek life onto campus where safety is easier to monitor. But because Greek chapters are privately run organizations, the school has had some difficulty getting all the Greek life chapters to give up their chapter homes. I think that currently the school, from what I saw, has 10 fraternities on campus, but still 7 off campus. And I couldn't find many stats on the sororities, just so you know. I was just trying to give you kind of a frame of reference. It's actually more fraternities than I would have thought, too. That's 17 fraternities.
It's a lot.
We had a lot on my school as well, but they were on campus, and I had a mid-sized school, but 17 did sound like a lot to me. One of these off-campus fraternities at NJIT is Tau Kappa Epsilon, or TEEK, a long-standing fraternity. However, on May 2, 2016, one of their members would fall victim to a violent crime. Before we get into the incident, though, Amy, I just want to give a little background on the city of Newark to help our listeners feel more oriented. You and I are quite familiar with Newark. In fact, I did some of my dissertation research in Newark at a courthouse there.
Yeah, and I've worked in Newark before, and my dad used to live in Newark, so yeah, I know Newark pretty well.
You worked in Newark? I didn't know that.
The prison, yeah.
Oh, of course. Okay, yes, I did. Well, while not the most crime-ridden city in the United States, Newark is ranked as the second most dangerous city in New Jersey, and it's in the top 100 most dangerous cities in the country.
What's first, Camden?
In New Jersey?
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting because that's exactly what I thought, although I didn't look it up. I didn't look it up, but I think Camden would be it. Like all cities, Newark has areas that are extremely beautiful, culturally significant, and fun to visit. And it hosts other universities such as Rutgers Newark and Essex County Community College. But unfortunately, can't get around the fact that crime statistics are high. As of 2015, Newark had 37 homicides per 100,000 residents. For reference, in the same year, New York City only had 4 homicides per 100,000 residents. So you can see that's a very big difference, and New York City has a much bigger population. Against this backdrop, let's discuss how NJIT was keeping students safe. For starters, NJIT has its own 89-member police department, consisting of sworn officers graduated from accredited police academies who patrol the campus and also do community policing with NJIT and the surrounding neighborhoods. So let me tell you about some of the things they do. I mean, they do coat drives for the homeless, and they do a lot to help the homeless in the area, connecting them with mental health, addiction, and housing resources, and also police and community liaisons. So they are really working with the community. There's also a police presence at the entrance of each campus building and in all parking areas, as well as an NJIT-specific first aid squad that only takes care of the campus. I mean, wow, right?
Wow. Yeah.
They also have a division of public safety officers, which we have on our campus, who are, in essence, I would say, like security guards, and a shuttle transport service shared with Rutgers Newark to transport students safely from parking lots and to off-campus locations.
Yeah, so they're really doing a lot. Tell me again what year this was, Megan.
Amy, this was the year 2016.
Oh, okay.
And yes, they are really doing a lot. And NJIT is acutely aware of the environment that it's located in. And a huge part of freshman orientation is dedicated to inner city awareness and personal safety, as well as safety refreshers once a semester for upperclassmen. So they've incorporated into their curriculum as well. And these include not just safety on campus, but also for those living off of campus, taking public transportation, walking around the city, and even how to deal with panhandlers and ATM thefts. The university has emergency help boxes around the campus that, when pressed, put out an immediate call to 911. And even the off-campus Greek life houses had levels of protection, with help boxes installed on the outside of the homes and private security systems in place. I mean, I think this is really doing the job. Not to mention, the city of Newark had also been working towards lowering crime for most of the 2010s, and by 2015, the city was showing a 20% decrease in violent crime. Now, I remember this, and I remember following the patterns, and I'd like to point out that a 20% decrease in violent crime is very, very significant. They were doing a very good job in decreasing their crime rates. However, unfortunately, this decrease doesn't matter to the actual people affected by the 80% of the crimes that still occur. And this was particularly true for NJIT's mechanical engineering major, Joe Michelizzi.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
23-year-old Joe Michelizzi transferred to NJIT in 2015 after completing his associate's degree with Brookdale Community College.
I went to Brookdale Community College.
You did?
And I live very close to Brookdale, yes.
I was going
to
ask that. Don't you live, what town is Brookdale located?
Lincroft.
It's located in your town.
It's like a mile from my house. Yes.
Oh, wow. I knew you went to community college, but I didn't know you started at Brookdale. Okay. A Freehold, New Jersey native, Joe was an avid wrestler, as I was saying, in high school, gaining his varsity letter in his junior year, and he was also academically gifted. He'd been a member of the National Honor Society in high school and had made the dean's list at NJIT in his very first semester. He'd also been inducted into the National Society of Collegiate Scholars in the spring of 2016. Now, Amy, this is a pretty high honor. Nominees for this must be in the top 20% of their class, maintain a 3.4 or higher GPA, and show extensive community service and demonstrate leadership. So, I mean, Joe is incredibly well-rounded. And he had joined the Teak Fraternity House upon arriving at NJIT and was an active member who helped organize Greek Week programs, as well as just being loved by his fraternity brothers and most of the other students he encountered. He was really living a very good life, I would say, the college dream here. He was described by one of his high school friends as just one of the nicest people I had the pleasure of knowing. His teachers and professors also loved him, with one of his high school teachers telling the press that Joe was, quote, disciplined, polite, focused, easy to work with, and this amazing combination of humble and respectful. Joe was also an active member of his church in Freehold and came from a very close-knit family that included his parents, two sisters, both sets of grandparents, and a large and supportive extended family. But nothing could have prepared anyone, least of all the Teak fraternity, for what would happen only 2 weeks before graduation. On May 2nd of 2016, classes had concluded and most students were holed up in their rooms studying for exams. You know, this might just be my own observation, Amy, but have you noticed that a lot of the tragedies that we cover seem to happen at the end of the semester?
Yeah, I wonder if that has to do with, like, well, we know there's a relationship between weather and crime, mm-hmm. so that could have to do with the weather getting nicer, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe
definitely
the stress of finals. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's just, again, just an observation, but something I thought of. Now, as a junior, Joe was in the thick of his collegiate courses and had several exams he was preparing for before going home for summer break. So around 3 a.m., Joe and his roommate were still awake when they were accosted in their third floor bedroom by two unknown assailants. What happens next isn't documented as there was no surveillance and Joe's roommate declined to speak to the press. Sources also disagreed on the specifics, with some saying that Joe may have been followed back to the chapter house on his way home from the local convenience store where he stopped around 2:30 a.m., Now, this may sound late to some people, but if you're studying for final exams, you know this can be all-nighters, energy drinks, food, snacks, sugar, all of the above. Others say Joe was already at the chapter house studying when two burglars broke in through the back door. So there's nothing definitive on exactly how the situation began, but what we do know is that the Teak House had been robbed twice only the month before. And here early in the morning hours of May 2nd, they were being robbed for a third time. According to sources, the two burglars demanded cash and the electronics Joe and his roommate were using to study. Now, remember, Joe was a lettered wrestler. And when it became clear these two men were trying to rob them, Joe refused their demands and a struggle ensued. During the struggle, unfortunately, one of the burglars pulled out a gun and shot Joe three times at point blank range before fleeing the scene with his partner. Joe's roommate immediately called 911 and tried to staunch the bleeding, but Joe had been shot in the hand and more fatally the head. So this was going to be hard. And though EMS arrived very quickly, Amy, and Joe was rushed to the hospitals where doctors worked for 2 hours to save him, Joe Michelizzi was pronounced dead from his wounds at 5:02 a.m. that morning. The robbery had just turned into a homicide.
So tragic.
It is so tragic. In the immediate aftermath of Joe Michelizzi's murder, NJIT sent a campus-wide email to all students with information on the shooting and assurance that campus security was being bolstered while the investigation was underway. Remember, they didn't catch the perpetrators right away. Teak House was evacuated now that it was a crime scene, and passersby found the 300th block of Martin Luther King Boulevard shut down and swarming with police cars and yellow caution tape. All Teak residents were given free on-campus housing for the remainder of the semester, and counseling stations were set up around campus for anyone who needed mental health assistance to process the situation. The president's message urged anyone who felt unsafe or uncomfortable to call public safety for a personal escort any time of day or night, and that the university would grant extensions to any students who felt that they would need extra time on their exams due to the stress and the trauma of Joe's loss. But was this enough to help the campus community feel safe? Well, for the most part, it was. Many students interviewed by the press in the days following Joe's murder cited more grief and sorrow that one of their own had been shot in his room than really personal fear for their own safety. A sorority sister who'd known Joe through their shared Greek Week activity stated that Joe's murder was just really heartbreaking and that Joe was just a wonderful person. When asked by the press if she was afraid, she and her friends both stated that they felt safe on campus and that NJIT provided plenty of safety precautions and email reminders for dealing with inner city life. Another student sadly cited that the safety tips and having to be constantly alert was, quote, just part of going to school in a neighborhood like this. But while the students were more upset about Joe's death than their own safety, the same wasn't true for many of their parents, who many of whom demanded that their students or their children be sent home early for the semester. When asked if NJIT would be changing any of its protocols going forward in light of Joe's murder, the president replied that aside from working closely with the Newark PD to help bring Joe's assailants to justice and bolstering on-campus security as they had already done, there wasn't much more that the school could do beyond that. Remember, Joe had been killed off-campus in a home with a security system, exterior surveillance, and a help call box directly connected to 911. So what else could Teak or NJIT have done to make it safer? I think they really prioritize safety in this case, Amy. Would you agree?
Well, you know, yeah, people, they're going to need to, obviously it's the perpetrator's fault, but mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times the university is blamed just because it's so tragic and we need someone to be held responsible. So I would imagine they're going to really throw the book at these perpetrators, as they should.
Yeah. Whenever there is a tragedy like this, there is also a knee-jerk reaction because we're so angry and we want to hold someone accountable. So, yes, it explains why the universities in some cases are blamed in the aftermath immediately. As the investigation was underway, the teak back door where the burglars had entered, it really didn't show any signs of forced entry. So it wasn't clear if the door had simply been left unlocked, which happens a lot in fraternity houses, or if the burglars had some type of tool to unlock the door. But it was clear that no damage had been done to the door, so this was hard to assess.
You said there were cameras, though, so this shouldn't be too difficult.
Yes, luckily for detectives, their exterior surveillance cameras had caught the assailants running away from the house and down the street. So this was good because Joe's roommate wasn't really able to give a good description of the assailants, things that happened quickly in the middle of the night, and obviously during a traumatic incident where a weapon was present.
Do we know if they were their identities concealed in any way? Do we know, like, were they wearing masks or anything?
It's a great question. We are not sure if they were wearing masks because some of the details of how they unveiled the perpetrators were kept very close or secret. But the surveillance gave the police a good place to start, so I have to imagine there are identifying features one way or the other. And the investigation proved a little bit complicated because in a broader scope, Joe's murder was the second in less than a month in the college area of Newark. So only 2 weeks prior, two Rutgers Newark students had been shot only blocks from their university. One died and one was in critical condition, though he did eventually recover. Not to mention the fact, Amy, that there had been a rash of break-ins and aggravated assaults in the college area in March and April of 2016. So it's complicated by the fact that you have to figure out, are they related? How do we disentangle these crimes? Who's responsible?
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
In light of the other violence Newark PD was contending with, NJIT put up a $10,000 reward to anyone in the community who had possible information on who had murdered Joe Michelizzi. And Essex County Crime Stoppers upped the ante with their own $10,000 reward, bringing the total reward to $20,000 for information about Joe's murder.
And I bet you somebody came forward and said something.
I don't know what would make you think that, how money motivates people. But though the police did not disclose to the media whether or not the reward incentive was how they got their leads, only 4 days after Joe's murder, Newark police had arrested two suspects. 18-year-old Nafi Cotman of Newark, New Jersey, and 22-year-old Taquan Harris of Irvington, New Jersey. Irvington, for anyone who doesn't know, is an urban center right outside of Newark. Both men were booked on charges of murder, burglary, robbery, and possession of a weapon, and they were held on bail at $1 million each, which is typical for the charges. Now, I couldn't find any in-depth information on how the investigation supported these two suspects being the burglars, but based on a comment by their defense attorney at their arraignment, and this is in the beginning of the process, the amount of evidence provided to the defense by the state was, quote, quite voluminous, and it would take the defense some time to prepare for any specific motions. You know, we don't know who their defense was, but the state has to turn over all information, all discovery, all the evidence that they've uncovered to the defense to give them time to prepare. But the state has more resources, and oftentimes they're up against public defenders who are inundated with cases, and they don't have the same capabilities or any assistance to go through voluminous records. As for these two men, both were already well known to law enforcement for other crimes. So Nafi had 10 juvenile cases and 5 adult arrests. Remember that he's only 18. So that means that's 5 arrests in 1 year. That's significant. And Taquan had 1 juvenile case and 6 adult arrests. Taquan was 22. But not two sure had never been convicted of anything with all of those charges, which I found surprising. We don't know. So were they dropped? It could also be that they were conditional releases. So if they were released without doing anything further, although Naffy's five adult arrests were when he was 18. So maybe they weren't resolved at the time yet. It could have been a number of factors. Although I did find it surprising with that number of arrests that there weren't any convictions. Unfortunately, I also couldn't find much on their backstories, either men, other than Taquan was the older brother of a budding basketball star who was being headhunted by college recruiters. But unfortunately, he was also arrested on drug charges in 2014. And then in 2016, he was arrested for assault charges. And ultimately, he was killed during what police described as an ambush incident in November of 2016. So that's very sad, someone who was showing so much promise as well. You know, to be going from, to be recruited for top schools, to have your life cut so short. Now, I couldn't find anything on Naffy's background, just so you know. But we do know as as youths who live in inner cities that are high in violence and crime, unfortunately, they are surrounded by the criminal elements, surrounded by temptations. They often live in poverty and just environments that are really conducive to crime. I mean, we could probably talk about this all day, but when we talk about theories of crime, one of the primary ones we discuss is social disorganization, which states that areas that are socially disorganized, that do suffer, have no cohesion, have higher crime rates. And I think that's how I probably would have described the conditions at the time. Okay, back to the case. In October of 2016, 6 months after Joe Michelizzi's murder, Naffy and Taquan stood before a grand jury and they were indicted officially on charges of murder, burglary, robbery, unlawful possession of a handgun, and then possessing it for unlawful purposes are actually two separate crimes. I mean, this was the federal system, but usually warranted at least a 3 to 5 year sentence.
I'm assuming there was only one trigger man. So one of them's being charged with felony murder, I would imagine, and one's being charged with first degree or second degree.
So I didn't see the mention of felony murder specifically, but yes, I believe that was implied in the charges. And I believe you'll see that when I get to the rest of the story.
Okay. All right.
Not surprisingly, at first, Naffy and Taquan pled not guilty to their charges, which most people do in the beginning, citing to the press that they were innocent and that the police had gotten the wrong men. At one point during the indictment, Taquan even directly addressed the presiding judge, asking that he be allowed to fire his state-appointed defense attorney on the grounds that he didn't feel the lawyer had his best interests at heart. I have to imagine that they were probably pressuring them from the start to take a plea deal, to be honest. Whether or not it was their best interest or not remains to be seen. The judge denied the request, citing that Taquan didn't appreciate his attorney's abilities and that Taquan, quote, can't just pick a public defender of your choosing. Now, as we've discussed in other cases and in our other podcasts, trials are a huge risk as the sentences are often much harsher in the event that a suspect is found guilty. We call that the trial penalty. People are actually punished for exercising their right to go to trial.
And that's because trials are time-consuming and expensive.
Yeah, I've actually seen judges warn people not to. I not so long ago witnessed a judge, and I won't say where or under what conditions, but I witnessed a judge in a criminal court. A defense attorney stood up and told the judge that his client wanted to exercise his right and go to trial, and the judge was so angry, warning him that he needed to go home and reconsider so he wouldn't enter a trial date, even though he requested it. And he told him, if you're found guilty, your sentence, I'm going to punish you a lot harsher than the sentence that you were offered. So the threat wasn't just implicit. It was overt, which really surprised me still right now and disappointed me, unfortunately. I don't know why I was surprised, but yet I guess the overt nature of it. Okay. And based on the defense attorney's opinion of this case, the chance of the jury finding Naffy and Taquan not guilty did not look good. However, Naffy and Taquan had opted at first to go to trial, which was scheduled to start on the morning of October 10th, 2018. But right before opening statements were supposed to begin, Naffy and Taquan put in a motion to change their not guilty plea to guilty. As part of this new plea deal, both admitted to entering the teak house on May 2nd and going up to the third floor bedrooms with the intent to rob the inhabitants. Daquan admitted that he had been in possession of a revolver that night and that he had indeed shot Joe Michelizzi 3 times. Naffy admitted that he had participated in the robbery event and that he'd helped Daquan escape after the shooting. For their guilty pleas, Daquan Harris was sentenced to 26 years in prison and Naffy Cotman was sentenced to 12 years in prison.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Now, as you know, in New Jersey, both men must serve up to 85% of their sentence under the NERA Act, which is the No Early Release Act. So that's 85% for being eligible for parole. This is pretty commonplace, though, in most jurisdictions. And when I teach about it, truth in sentencing means that people have to serve 85% of their sentence. When my students ask me, why 85%, why not 100%, I explain that they still need to have incentives to be released early, and there still has to be incentives for good behavior in the institution. So that really means that Daquan will have to serve 22 years, and Naffy will serve 10 years. Sorry, Amy, before I move on to talk about, you know, the end of this case, do you think this is an appropriate sentence?
Seems a little light to me. And I'm actually surprised because I feel like we're typically a little more punitive in New Jersey.
Yeah, I was a little bit. I guess I wasn't as surprised about Naffy, although with felony murder, he could have just as easily been sentenced to life. So 10 years, 22. It did seem a little light to me as well. Anyway, regardless of our opinions that it was a little bit light, that's the sentence that was agreed upon. And that doesn't also necessarily mean they get out at that time. It means they come up for release at that time. So I guess we'll have to follow up in these cases in 10 and 22 years. Meanwhile, what about Joe Michelizzi and his legacy? On May 3rd, only one day after Joe's murder, his Teak brothers held a vigil in his memory on the grass outside the campus's main building. Hundreds of students came to light candles and share stories about Joe. His brothers made speeches describing Joe as a hero and a true friend. His Teak brother, Christian Chavez, said, "I feel like it was kind of heroic of him going out like that, protecting his house and his brothers. He was not only a role model for his frat brothers, but to everyone on this campus." That same day, then New Jersey Governor Christie happened to be on campus to tour one of NJIT's new buildings, and he'd prepared a speech in light of Joe's tragic murder the night before as well. The speech is quite beautiful, Amy, and we've attached it in our show notes for those who'd like to read the whole thing, but I want to read just a small portion here. "Condolences are not enough. I am a father of 4. There could never be enough condolences that could be given to a mother or a father who lose their child. It's the most unnatural thing that could happen to anyone in the normal arc of life. We expect our children to be there for us when we die, not the other way around. For those of you who know this family personally, I'd urge you. It's always an awkward thing, but don't stay away. Move forward, embrace them. And as parents, let them know how much you feel their pain. It will help. I guarantee it will help." On May 11, 2016, 9 days after the shooting, Joe Michelizzi's family gathered for his funeral mass in Freehold, New Jersey. His family mourned the loss of his promising life, holding tightly to the knowledge that Joe had died not as the helpless victim of some random crime, but fighting off his assailants. His family, friends, high school teachers, professors, Teak brothers, and those from the Freehold community, all of whom he'd touched, all came to lay him to rest at the St. Rose Lima Catholic Cemetery. Now, while most talked about the bravery or about his bravery at fighting off his attackers, one of his beloved teachers, former high school teacher Rachel Burkhart, hopes that Joe is remembered most for his kindness. "The thing she still holds most dear when she thinks of Joe is the enormous bear hug he gave her on the day of his graduation. She says he had such a kind heart. He was a little shy at times, but there was a lot more to him than you caught at first glance." May 17th, 2016, NJIT hosted commencement, and their first degree was posthumously awarded to Joe Michelizzi. The president of the school announced, after reviewing Joe's earned credits, courses completed, grades, and other pertinent information, NJIT awarded the posthumous degree as a humanitarian act for the Michelizzi family, friends, and the many others in the campus community who knew and loved Joe. Joe's degree in mechanical engineering was accepted on his behalf by TEEK student president Dan Weiss. In an ironic twist, at almost the very moment Joe's degree was being conferred, his assailants, Nafi and Taquan, were both being arraigned for Joe's murder in the Superior Courthouse just a few blocks from the graduation ceremony. And that really brings us to the end of today's episode. And while today's episode was less about policy, procedure, or the failings of any safety system, it was more about the issues of situational crime and the overarching societal frameworks that kind of create environments such as the city of Newark. I just want to point out, there are many organizations working to disassemble these frameworks. And if our listeners are interested in learning more, we recommend checking out some of the following places. You can check out the Newark Community Street Team at newarkcommunitystreetteam.org, the Center for Justice Innovation, which we know pretty well, at innovativejustice.org, and the Newark Communities for Accountable Policing at newarkpolicereform.org. That brings us to the end of today's episode. And again, I chose this because of its relevance. Also, we know the city quite well. And we've both seen the city at high crime times and at lower crime times. And it is a fantastic city. There are so many culturally significant spots in Newark, and I do always hope that we can see it move into, you know, to be one of the safer cities, especially for the many students that live there.
Before we go today, if you'd like to support Campus Killings, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcasts.
Your subscription will get you VIP access to all the shows on the network. That not only includes hundreds of episodes of ad-free listening, but also bonus content and early access to episodes.
For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits and you'll be supporting this show in the process.
Head over to Apple Podcasts and search for either Campus Killings or Abjack, and you can start your subscription with a free trial.
Your support is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Abigail Belcastro. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook at facebook.com/campuskillings. You can also visit the show's homepage at campuskillings.com. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.